There we go. You're all set. And all right. Here's our president, Ellen Schwartz.
Hi, I'm Ellen Schwartz. I'm the president of the board of directors of the Marxist School. And eventually we're going to have a speaker pretty soon. So I'll get this part out of the way. Oh, if you have a cell phone, silence it, please. I'm very grumpy about those things. Or anything else that makes any noise. I think that's obligatory to say that. Bathrooms are down that way. You may have to take your own paper towels and toilet paper on your way in.
Oh, you do?
Not necessarily. No. It's stop. All right. Hi, everybody. Beyond Mitt Romney's binders full of women, which, by the way, masks the fact that he ignored the question he was asked about pay equity, beyond that is the unpaid and unrecognized work that women do in creating and providing for the next generation of workers. Our speaker tonight, Silvia Federici, has spent 40 years researching and theorizing on the nature of housework, the bearing and rearing and caring for children, and women's struggles in that area. Sylvia is a feminist writer, teacher, and militant. In 1972, she was the co-founder of the International Feminist Collective, which launched the Wages for Housework campaign. In the 1990s, after a period of teaching and research in Nigeria, she was active in the anti-globalization movement and the U.S. anti-death penalty movement. She's one of the co-founders of the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa, an organization dedicated to generating support for the struggles of students and teachers in Africa against the structural adjustment of African economies and education systems. From 1987 to 2005, she also taught international studies, women's studies, and political philosophy courses at Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Her new book, Revolution at Point Zero, which is available over there, which you can buy at the break or afterwards, deals with power and politics of wide issues, including the international restructuring of reproductive work and its effects on the sexual division of labor, the globalization of care work and sex work, the crisis of elder care, and the development of affective labor, and the politics of the commons. I think we're going to learn a lot tonight, so please welcome our speaker, Silvia Federici.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening, and thank you to the organizer of this evening for having invited me here. And also thank you to PMS, who has contributed to this evening. I want to start by saying a few things about the title of the book, and then I will summarize the main themes in the three parts of the book, and hopefully we'll have a discussion on it. Revolution at Point Zero. I chose this title because I was very inspired by a book by an Egyptian writer that probably you know, Nawal el-Saadawi, who wrote in the early 80s a book called Woman at Point Zero. And it's a book, again, that if you have not read, I suggest you put immediately on your reading agenda. When I've read it many, many times, and it made a profound impression on me. Woman at Point Zero, the idea of the point zero in this book indicate a moment in life when everything has been lost. It's the story of a woman who is waiting to be hanged because she killed the pimp who was dominating her life. And the killing is very symbolic. It's symbolic of a realization that any possible adjustment, any possible adaptation to this world is impossible. In fact, even before killing the man, she tears a whole wad of banknotes, which is also symbolic of the complete refusal of this world. And I've chosen, at the same time, Point Zero in the book clearly indicates also the moment in which something new becomes possible, because it's the moment in which all illusions about alternative has gone. So So I've taken this title and I've adjusted it to express my understanding of the situation in which we are living today, and the situation that I think becomes very clear when we look at the world, and I guess we look at our lives from the point of view of reproduction, in the sense that globally and certainly also locally, we are in a situation in which from so many different angles, the means that we have to reproduce ourselves have been under-resourced and they've been destroyed. And so many people now are living at the edge of death. By the same token, I also believe that the issue of reproduction, the question of reproduction, is also the one from which we can start or restart to reconstruct a different type of life and reconstruct a different type of society. And I want to clarify immediately what I mean by reproduction. As if you read the book, you will see that that concept continuously changes, you know, through the book itself. That it begins in the first part of the book, reproduction is mostly identified with housework, with domestic labor, but more and more it takes on broader meanings. For example, reproduction begins to include all subsistence economies, subsistence-oriented economies, subsistence-oriented farming, for example, as well as education, as well as all the range of activity by which our life is day-to-day reproduced. And at the same time, the workforce, the labor force, is also reproduced. So the concept of reproduction changes, but there is a continuity. There is a continuity, and that continuity is a particular perspective from which I look at this reality. And a good part of the first part of the book, it's really an explanation of this perspective. It's really an explanation of a certain category that I use to approach the question of reproduction. The second part of the book, in effect, applies this category particularly to the understanding of the global economy and the restructuring of the global economy. And then in the third part, I look at the question of the commons, which and the politics of the commons, and particularly the contribution that women's and women's struggles have been making and are making to that politics. Now, when I speak of a perspective, when I say that the first part of the book develops a certain perspective, what I refer to is a kind of analysis that together with other women in the women's movement, and in particular other women in an organization that was called the International Campaign for Wages for Housework, in which I became involved in the early 70s, that we did the perspective that together with these women we developed, we discussed, and elaborated. In the women's movement, the issue of housework, domestic work, was extremely, extremely important. Even though most of us came from a position, if you want, of refusal. I think that feminism, the rise of the women's movement in a certain way can be read as being motivated, you know, by a kind of generational refusal of women to become housewife, to see their life determined from by maternity, child raising, domestic labor, which is what all of us had been told was our primary destiny, whatever else we did, was our primary destiny as women. And I think that if there was something of a common denominator that underline the feminism, the reason why women joined the women's movement, it was precisely this refusal of, quote, femininity and refusal of a certain type of social position, social expectation that was still very strong, at least in the 60s and even early 70s, when the women's movement really took off. In the first part of the book, I look at the source of this refusal. I know that in the United States there are many theories that attribute this refusal to the experience of women in the war, to the fact that many, many women, like Rosie the Riveter, you know, took on jobs when the men were at the front. They had for the first time a true experience of independence. They saw what the paycheck would do, had a different kind of sociality. And I think that is very important. I certainly believe that the war was a kind of watershed from the point of view of women understanding of their position and their expectation for the future. I come from Italy, and I believe that women of my generation in Italy also had something of a different experience, that for us the refusal of housework, the refusal of domesticity also came from the experience in a much more direct way of the devastation that the war produced. In a way, the war in Europe, in my view, broke the social contract. You know, there was a hidden social contract between women and the state. If you are you know, you do your role as a woman, you're a good mother, you do your housework, have your children, there will be a certain protection, certain guarantees. The war broke that contract. It became very clear that, in fact, all those protections were illusory. And I think that there was a revulsion, a revolt against the idea of producing more children that the state was sent to be slaughtered in a battlefield. So for me, the question of not repeating my mother's life was very strong in my youth, and it was something that attracted me, motivated to join the women's movement. But of course, in the movement, there were many different positions as to what this housework was about, what domesticity was about, why women have been confined to this work, and what specific function or role domestic labor played in the subordination of women and gender discrimination. Generally, there were two dominant positions, as many of you probably remember. You know, one position was the position of radical feminists who believed that the discrimination, gender discrimination, then women's subordination to men has very old roots, as old roots in the system that was defined as patriarchy. And it's a system that has preceded capitalism, has a long cultural history. At the same time, there were also many Marxist socialist feminists who instead believed that housework was really central to the question of discrimination against women, in the sense that women are being subordinate to men in capitalism because being confined to domestic labor, they have been excluded from the most important work, or at least the work that has been most socially recognized in capitalist society. In other words, they've been excluded from socially necessary labor, understood in a capitalist sense. In the sense they have not contributed to the accumulation of capital, and therefore they have not been able to benefit from even the relative advantages that the male wage worker has been able to benefit from. The organization I belong to took a very, very different position. It took the position that, you know, far from being unimportant, actually, the domestic labor the women have performed in the home has been perhaps the most important activity in capitalist society, in that labor has produced and reproduced on a daily and generational basis the workforce, the laborer itself. And therefore, without that work, no other work would have been possible. So we took we actually in a way turned the table around, certainly with respect to Marx's analysis, and we basically said that Marx made a very profound mistake when in his analysis of capitalism and his analysis of the capitalist organization of work singled out almost exclusively as his focus, you know, wage labor and production based on the wage system. What Marx ignored was that much of the work that takes place in capitalist society has enabled the capitalist class to expand its power, has been labor that has been unwaged, has been labor that has been performed mostly in the home by unpaid workers, mostly women. This kind of analysis, this redefinition of housework as work that produces the workforce, rather than work that in a way, it's not really work, it's a personal service, an act of love. This kind of analysis, in a way, began a process of re-examination of what is capitalism itself. You know, an analysis that began with attempt to understand the sources of women's oppressions, women's exploitation, gender discrimination, in reality began a whole investigation. We realized, in effect, capital, although we all came from a sort of Marxist perspective, we realized that Marx's capital had to be rewritten. And it had to be rewritten in a way that would incorporate as a central component of the process of production and capitalist accumulation, the reproduction of labor power. And as we did that, we began to discover many, many, many aspects of capitalist production that are absent in Marx. For example, we began to discover that the amount of unpaid labor that the capitalist class accumulated is far vaster than Marx acknowledges. In fact, extending not only to the labor that is not paid, the labor of the wage worker that is not paid, which is the source of profit for Marx, but actually extending to all the unpaid labor that takes place in the kitchen and bedrooms of the world in which the reproduction of labor force takes place, and without which, in fact, the accumulation of capital would be drastically curtailed because all the unpaid labor the women have provided has, in fact, served to reduce the cost of the reproduction of the workforce. That in fact, an essential aspect, an essential element of the capitalist assembly line has been precisely that moment of unpaid reproduction, which has allowed, in fact, for the containment of the cost of labor. So we also were able to see that the working day, for example, Marx's famous chapter on the working day of the working class is a far longer and is a far broader working day than it has been acknowledged in the Marxist tradition. And the most important, we began to redefine, you know, what is the wage and what has been the function of the wage and the wage relation. For instance, recognizing that the wage is not only the payment for part of the work that the wage worker performs, but actually the wage and wage relation has served to organize society in a particular way. That is, that the wage has been the instrument for deconstruction first of hierarchy, of a whole set of labor hierarchy, so that the wage worker is at the top of the labor hierarchy, and beneath are many, many types of unwaged labor. So that in fact the whole hierarchization of labor, which has been the source of sexism and racism, has actually been organized through the wage and the lack of it. And secondly, the wage has also enabled capitalism to delegate power to certain sectors of the working class over other sectors of the working class. In the case of the relation between women and men, it has basically allowed capital to delegate to the male worker, and primarily the white male worker, you know, power over the labor and the body of women, which has been a very important mechanism, a very important disciplinary mechanism, because through that delegation, you enhance the discipline of labor, and you also divide, you create tension, division within the working class, and you certainly, that delegation has had a tremendous function of pacifying workers, of pacifying the male worker, who may be exploited in the factory, in the offices, but certainly has been able to have a much more sovereign role in his home. So we began a kind of analysis that, in a way, developed, a new perspective on capitalism. And in fact, I began to see my work as less and less, describing the position of women in capitalism, although it is also that, and more and more as presenting a feminist analysis of capitalism, which is something somewhat different. This is the framework that, and I also want to add that, of course, we realized that, at least our argument was, that because so much of this work has been unwaged, in a society where wages and work have become synonymous, this work itself has become naturalized, has been made invisible, and has been, in a sense, presented as a kind of natural thing, is something pertaining to women's nature, pertaining to their physiological and psychological makeup. That's what we mean by naturalization. So that, for example, certain attributes that have been attributed to women, or at least expected women to have, right, and they've been presented as natural, as what it means to be a good woman, we were able to redefine and then say, these are work attributes, these are specifications, these are work functions, and in fact, one of the first articles that in their book, which is called Wages Against Housework, begins with, a caption saying, they say it's love, we say it's unpaid labor. Abortions are work accident, etc., etc. They call it fragility, we call it absenteeism, and so forth. Right, and this was the spirit in which we looked at this work. This is the framework that I use by the late 80s, first to begin a certain type of historical work. I was pretty much clear in the kind of analysis, what were the implications of the analysis that we have produced. But I became very, very interested in trying to understand how this work had evolved. In other words, at what point capitalism had transformed this work into something that would be integrated into the organization of work, and would be, for example, would acquire certain specific characteristics, like being completely feminized, which was not the case in pre-capitalist society. In pre-capitalist society, production and reproduction are not separated, right? You farm, and if the production is for subsistence, you consume, the food that you produce, right? So you don't have the separation of production and reproduction. That separation begins with capitalism, right? When in a way the economy undergoes this process of bifurcation. Right? You have on one side production for the market, production of goods, and that's recognized as work, that's recognized as producing wealth. And on the other, you have this other pool of invisible labor, you know, the bottom of the iceberg. The top of the iceberg is production of commodity, as Maria Mies, a German feminist, has pointed out. And the bottom of the iceberg is all this pool of labor. It remains mostly invisible, done by women, taken for granted, unpaid, and so forth. I wanted to understand how did it come into existence? When this separation took place? And so I began to do a lot of historical work, and if you're interested in the story, you should also buy another book I've written, which is called Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation. And briefly, what I do in that book, I return to the origin of capitalism, I return to the crisis of the feudal system, try to understand why capitalism, what led to the development of capitalist relation. And again, because I looked at that process in a different way, from a different angle than Marx did, although I used Marx and I found that Marx is extremely important, but I looked at that process also from the point of view of the reproduction of labor, the reproduction of labor power, I developed a very different picture of the transformation of relation from feudal society to capitalist society. And I began to realize that some very, very important processes that took place in that transition had been completely ignored by Marx. And in particular, what I saw Marx as having ignored has been the 2 centuries-long process of witch hunting that took place in Europe, and to some extent also in the Americas, particularly Peru, the whole Andean region, that basically led to the extermination of hundreds of thousands of women who were accused of being witches. And a good part of Caliban and the Witch is an analysis of what role the witch hunt, what used to be called, historians used to call the great witch hunt, has performed in the process of capitalist development. And I come to the conclusion that the witch hunts that took place in Europe, England, Germany, Scotland, Italy, Switzerland, you know, in fact, all that area where capitalist relation began first, I come to the conclusion that those witch hunts were an important, essential moment of what Marx called primitive accumulation, right? Primitive accumulation being the process that sets the condition for the takeoff of capitalist society, right? When you read Marx, Marx tells you that primitive accumulation was essentially the process of the expulsion of the peasantry from the land. Right? In other words, capitalism, in order to develop, had to create a population of landless workers, of workers who had no means of reproduction, had to destroy the common land, the communal system of land, which was still in place, fence off, enclose the commons. And on that basis, you had now a landless proletariat who was whipped into the path to the path of the labor market. Well, the analysis that I developed in Caliban and the Witch is that, yes, that was very important, but the expulsion of the peasantry from the land, you know, was only the first important step, but was not sufficient, in fact, to create the condition for the capitalist discipline of labor. And that in order to do that, a whole set of practices, a whole set of attitudes, a whole set of struggles had to be destroyed. and that the great witch hunts and the attack on women perform that function. And for example, destroyed a certain conception of sexuality, destroyed the social power that women had gained with regard to men in the process of the struggle of the Middle Ages and so forth. I'm not going to go too much into that because I really want to talk about evolution at point zero. I only want to say that the framework that I had, the framework that we had elaborated, because it was a collective process, you know, in our analysis of the place the reproduction has performed, you know, the place the reproduction has had in the capitalist organization of labor, that framework became very important for me to reread a certain history, and enable me to see, you know, I think a whole history that certainly is missing in Marx. In Marx, for example, there's no analysis, there's no recognition of the existence of witch hunts, which is quite amazing, because here you had, at the very dawn of capitalism, in the same years when the peasantry was expelled from the land, you know, when the Americas were being colonized, when a market economy was beginning to take roots, and when the slave trade also was beginning, right? You have the extermination of hundreds of thousands of women decapitated, burnt at the stake. You'd imagine that this would be something that would call for an explanation, but in fact, that explanation is not there. And in fact, the witch hunt has been ignored by most historians, and in fact, has been so erased from the collective memory that now we can turn into a children's game, so that in a month from now we are going to have children doing trick or treat, not knowing that behind that there is a story of atrocious tortures and execution. That framework that I use to understand the history of capitalism is also a framework that enabled me, or that I've used, and this is particularly part two of Revolution at Point Zero. That's where, you know, it's the most evident. I've used this to look at the development of the global economy, at the restructuring that started in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, began to take place in the global economy, the process that we now call globalization. There's been a broad literature, there is a huge literature on the question of globalization, and particularly when I began to, you know, write some of my first analysis on the process of globalization, the main tendency was again to look at it from the point of view of the transformation that it brought about in the organization of commodity production. So, in fact, for many years, most of the analysis had to do on the relocation of industry, the fact that industry was relocated from, the industrialized country to parts of the third world, the flexibilization of labor, precarization of labor, the fact that more and more capital has become deterritorialized, etc., etc. And so already by the early 90s, I was in fact challenging the view and saying, yes, there's another part of the story that has to be told, which I have to say now it's more and more integrated. And the other part of the story is the story of what has taken place to reproductive work. Because hand in hand with that restructuring of industry has gone also a restructuring of reproductive work. And some of it, I think, now is very obvious. For instance, the fact that many, many women in the industrialized countries, certainly in the United States and most of Europe, have, a large part of Europe, have been, I would not say have left the home, because I don't believe that women have ever left the home in a way, but have increasingly exchanged much work in the home with work in the wage workplace. So there's been this massive interest, which we all acknowledge, of women in the wage workforce. At the same time, however, in other parts of the world, Africa, Asia, Latin America, many, many women have lost the wage employment they used to have through the liberalization of the economy, through the program imposed by the World Bank and the IMF, for example, through the structural adjustment program, right, that forced this economy to liberalize, to open up to imports, for example, from the United States of the European Union, so that the local industry was destroyed. It's very important that we recognize that, because the story that with globalization, women have entered the workforce, which women? Where? In fact, in many parts of the world, throughout Eastern Europe, millions of women lost their jobs with the end of socialism. In fact, many women were expelled and they became part of the huge migrant labor force that in fact has begun to cross the world in search for an income. And the same can be said for the situation of women in large parts of Africa and Asia, Latin America, who also have been expelled from their workplaces because of the structural adjustment program that the World Bank imposed, right? So what I look at, keeping in mind these two phenomena, I look in the second part of the book at the kind of restructuring of the global economy and restructuring of reproductive work. You know, how reproduction is being restructured, particularly in the United States and in Europe. And what has become clear is that large parts of the reproduction of the metropolitan workforce has been shifted onto the shoulders of women coming from the former colonial world, right? And so that, as we know, increasingly you have, in fact, large parts of reproductive labor that are done by immigrant domestic workers, nurses, sex workers. We have also seen the development of a baby market, you know, through the basically massification of abortion, adoption, and more recently, a growing egg market. Right now in Europe, there's a lot of research that women are doing in what is becoming the new boom, and in quote, the fact that women, in order to have some income and not only sell their body in prostitution, in sex work, or sell their body, their womb, in surrogacy, or may give away their children in adoption, but also now sell their eggs. Because all the research for staminal cells, for instance, depend on eggs taken from the bodies of women, right? So this new development certainly cast a very, very different picture from the one that is usually propagated, promoted, for example, by government and United Nations, who are now hailing to the emancipation of women. How come women have been emancipated in the process of globalization? I come to the conclusion that the opposite is in fact the case. That, in fact, in the very years in which the United Nations presented itself, posed itself as the sponsors of women's rights, and was proclaiming that you know, women's rights had to be integrated and embraced by governments, almost across the world, the position of women has deteriorated because of the, you know, policies that neoliberalism has brought into existence, which in different forms but consistently have undermined, attacked, in some cases destroyed, the means of subsistence that millions of people had relied upon. Briefly, there has been a assault on subsistence economy and communal land systems. for example, throughout Africa and Latin America, there's been an assault on common lands and a major wave of land grabbing, unprecedented, as now you have a mining company, agribusiness, agrofuel, you know, all seeking to appropriate, for instance, African land and the minerals that are having that land. There's also been part of this expropriation, by the way, has been also accomplished through the mechanism of war. I have an article in Revolution 8.0 that looks at the question of war from the point of view of reproduction. So using the prism of reproduction has been very interesting in seeing aspects of the social political transformation that I think probably I would not have seen, you know, that how in fact war it's also a means, you know, to change economic relations. It's a mean to displace people from land, right? It's a mean, for example, to you know, create large population of landless people and refugees who then go to, you know, enlarge the global workforce, and in that they go to facilitate new, more intense forms of exploitation. And we also have the fact that across the board, in across countries, although with different degrees of intensities, the governments, the state, has, you know, adopted a policy of no investment, almost no investment in the reproduction of the workforce. You know, until the 60s, for instance, there was a recognition that the state should invest in the process of reproduction. For example, should invest in education, should invest in healthcare, because a healthier population of workers, a more educated population of workers would be more productive and would be, in a sense, more capable of participation in a democratic system. Well, now that has been clearly renounced. The shift in power relations that have taken place at the end of the 70s and 80s, and we can discuss what that has implied, has given the capitalist class the upper hand. The war and other forms of repression have, in fact, and expropriation, have in fact enlarged by millions the global workforce, which means that capitalism, in a way, has been able to regain the initiative, at least in the 90s, and up to these days, they've been able to regain the initiative. And as a result, we are approaching the situation that I described in, at the beginning of my presentation, which is the zero point of reproduction. The fact that no matter from which angle you look at it, right, reproduction now is, for most people, a battle. Is for most people an incredible day-to-day challenge. We are facing a situation in which, as I said before, the government tells us that it's our responsibility, that we are the one who have to take care of our reproduction and, for example, invest in our education, invest in our healthcare, invest in our pensions. Right? We have to begin to look at ourselves as little micro-entrepreneurs, as little capitalists who, starting from a very early age, begin to put aside a little money so that when we are old, because nothing is owed to us any longer. Right? So it's very difficult in a short time to give a sense of the broadness of the transformation that have taken place over the last three decades. But certainly there's been a concomitant of developments that has basically brought to a point in which more and more people realize that we have to take, in a way, our own reproduction into our hands. Not because we necessarily want to allow the state to maintain in its hand the resources that we have paid into and they've taken away from us, but because we need to actively engage in a process of struggle. Otherwise, we will soon arrive in a world in which we will not be able to have access to any resource, any space, without at a tremendous cost that most of us will not be able to pay. I'm going to conclude speaking a bit about the third part of the book, in which I begin to discuss the question of the commons and or the part, what I call the politics of the commons. I think the situation that has come into existence has developed because of the process of globalization, because of the transformations that I've referred to, is one of the reasons why in the last at least 15, 20 years, you know, in more broader radical circles, the ideas of the common has come back with some prominence. And of course, there are many interpretations of what we mean by commons. There are some people, when they speak of commons, of the need for us to recreate commons, have in mind, for instance, electronic commons, the internet as a kind of new commons where ideas circulate, where more and more we can share the wealth of ideas that is being produced collectively. I'm much more interested in a broader definition of commons, in a definition of commons that looks not only at cultural commons, at commons that are involved in the production of knowledge, but rather commons also that have a material basis. And in the last part of the book, I look at the struggles that women across the world have been making to basically collectivize, to create collective forms of reproduction out of the necessity to cope with this assault on the means of their subsistence. For example, all through Africa and Latin America, women have been squatting land, reappropriating land. There's been a tremendous movement of land squatters, women and men, but also women have been in the forefront. For example, with the practice of urban farming in many African towns. Lots of plots of public land have been taken over and been transformed into farms, and out of that practice also some small micro activity have been developed, giving women a certain degree of autonomy. Also in Latin America, there's been across the region many forms of collective reproduction, for example, through collective shopping, collective cooking, in situation in which women had no money, massive devaluation was continually taking place. And so one form of survival was in fact to begin to pool resources and begin to organize collectively the forms of reproduction. So I look at those examples because in some ways those examples are very important also for us. And briefly and concluding, because I really like to have some discussion, I see a situation developing in which increasingly we need to reopen a struggle on this terrain. We need to reopen a struggle on the terrain of reproduction, because we are reaching such a point of crisis, given the kind of cuts that are being introduced of essential services, given the foreclosing of spaces that are available to us, whether it is a home or a sidewalk or a beach, everything is being marketized. Given also the privatization and marketization of education, right? And also the ecological degradation that we are confronting, where more and more we are in a situation that we do not know if what we eat poisons us or nourishes us. We are basically in an environment that is not as radioactive as, for example, Tokyo now is, or large parts of Japan are after the disaster at Fukushima, but certainly increasingly is so contaminated as to put into question our ability to survive. So in that sense, I see the politics of the common as a politics of collective struggling, of initiating collective struggle on the terrain of reproduction, and we begin to recreate forms of cooperation that reconstitute the social fabric, in a way that enables us to actually begin to challenge the state and to challenge the capitalist system. Thank you.
Mike? Michael? Michael? Mm-hmm.